Hey everyone, I'm DeMelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. Chris Grace is an actor I've enjoyed in such TV shows as The Adorable Jerry in Superstore on Peacock or Hulu, Atypical on Netflix, and the more recent The Residence, also on Netflix. I just finished watching his solo show, Chris Grace as Scarlett Johansson at Portland Center Stage in a co-production with Boom Arts. The show runs through June 22nd in the Ellen By Theater at PCS, and that's where we are right now. I'm recording live on location at PCS with actor, writer, comedian, Chris Grace. It's so great to meet you.
Oh, thanks for having me. And you've been allowed into the inner sanctum here at the theater. Not everyone gets access this deep behind the scenes.
We're in the dressing room. Yeah. Yay. I know. It's really great. And I loved your show. It's an unusual structure, but it's also not unusual in sort of the multiverse world. Mm-hmm. And it rang true to me when you said one of your favorite movies was Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there is that sort of, you know, start again structure without giving too much spoilers. But it really is, you know, you go to somebody's solo show, mm-hmm. right? It really has, I think, a unique way of telling the story because you stop and start and start all over again. Mm-hmm. Where did you get that structure from?
I think it's a structure that sort of created itself. I think it makes a lot of sense for its own values, I guess. Like, it makes sense from within the show that it's structured like this. And then I just sort of followed the logic of the show as far as it would go. It mostly comes from when playing one real life person that's creating a biography of another real life person, what would happen if the subject found out about the show? And that's really where it came from. It was a question of, if I did a show about Scarlett Johansson, what would she think if she heard about the show? And in my world, her response is to make a show about me. And so it just sort of goes from there. And then it kind of just cascaded in terms of, I let it go where it wanted to go. I let it go how deep it wanted to go. And then the challenge then is wrangling it all back into hour-long show that is not, that doesn't just spiral off into meaninglessness.
Oh, I don't think it does that at all. I think you get the meaning in different spots, you know, and it starts to go very, very deep, and then you sort of pull out of that. And I'm wondering what that motivation was, because a lot of times with solo shows, you do go into sort of your heart a lot. And I could see that when you were talking about your mom and then you got interrupted a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it comes from, as a comedian, I'm always aware of, if I see a show, what are the things that I would say about the show? Like, if I'm watching a play, in my mind, I'm like, well, that wouldn't happen. Why would that, you know, why is this happening now? Or why don't they just say this? Or why doesn't he just say he's a ghost or whatever it is, you know? And so I think that the play develops with a lot of moments that I allowed myself to say, okay, we've gone this far in the play. Now, what would my objections be to the play so far? And then I can give voice to those things. And then those things create knock-on effects that also have things that need to be responded to. And so I think the play ends up being, in a fun way, a piece that's like talking to itself over and over and over, and kind of reflects some of the internal conversations you have with yourself as you're trying to fit in America. You know, you're always kind of gauging, how does the thing that I say or the way that I look, how is it going to be received by other people? And I think that's somebody everybody can relate to.
Well, I think it's apropos that your show is May, which is NHAAPI month. Mm. Actually, it's one of the few shows in Portland that is happening in May that is NHAPI. And I'm wondering if you can walk us back, because I remember the controversy of Scarlett Johansson when she was cast in a traditionally Asian role in The Ghost in the Shell. And when I saw the title of your show, I got it. You know, I got why you're doing this and what the meaning behind that is. You talk a little bit about the impetus for it when you saw that, but can you sort of walk me through when you thought, okay, I'll play Scarlett Johansson?
I just thought, you know, if I think that there's an empowerment in terms of people that don't have all the advantages, just saying like, well, if you can do it, I can do it too. That's really, I mean, in a way, I mean, I can put more pretentious reasons around it, but part of it is just like, I think sometimes if you're not the straight, white, cis man that gets to dominate our culture, there's a part of you that kind of envies the freedom that you perceive them having. Some of them might feel that they don't have that freedom, but a lot of times you just think, man, you, for example, I might see a show in Los Angeles where I live that's a play, and it'll have like 9 people in it, and all of the actors were white. And I just think, wow, it never occurred to you. It either never occurred to you that you should have maybe considered casting this in a more diverse way, or you considered it and it didn't mean much to you. At any rate, you have a relationship to the industry that doesn't require you to calculate all the time how you interact with it. And that is like to be envied, I think. I actually don't want to bring everybody down to the level of always having to, you know, hustle and maneuver and get into spots that aren't meant for them. I actually want everyone to feel, like I say in the play, like I think anyone should be able to play anyone. So that is the goal, you know? And so I think part of that impetus was just, I want to play Scarlett Johansson. I'm just going to give myself permission to do so.
I think that's why I gravitated so much to sci-fi when I was growing up, especially Star Trek, because there were a lot of different people, you know, and it was okay. And it wasn't like, there were sometimes statements about race, but it was like, who's qualified to do what for whatever job. And, yeah. You know, and I don't see that. I didn't see that in theater a lot.
I think that sci-fi and like technological, like fiction appeals to a lot of people where you're creating these worlds where rationality is the main driving force, you know, especially Star Trek, which is we are ambassadors to all these different worlds, and we're going to engage with everybody on a value of how do they behave, how does their behavior impact other people. And so because Star Trek has the advantage of being like hundreds of years in the future, then you can imagine that there is a world where, you know, Klingons and human beings and, you know, the Borg can all like, I guess we can't all live together.
I don't think
the Borg can't, but you know, but I think that's why it's appealing to people. I think that's why sci-fi and fantasy genre fiction often is appealing to marginalized people, because, you know, probably there's a parallel too in the equivalent. So what I was going to say was that in literary fiction and the equivalent of whatever that equivalent is in theater, which is like mainstream accepted theater, there probably aren't as many voices speaking about your experiences growing up. You know, it's great to see Shakespeare and all that stuff and Chekhov and things like that. But I know the feeling when you go see a play or a movie or a TV show, the first time you see something that is actually specifically talking about your experience, it's so much more powerful than the decades that you have spent projecting yourself into people that don't look like you. And as marginalized people, we get very good at that, you know? So I can watch Breaking Bad and I imagine that I'm a chemistry teacher and now I'm making meth or whatever, right? But then if I see The Farewell and it's about an elderly Chinese relative, and I've been in situations like that, and I've had moments that really were mirrored in a piece of work like that, it's like almost like you were like riding a bicycle with training wheels for a bunch of years, and then it gets unleashed and your emotional connection to those things is so much stronger.
I don't think that we've arrived at a time where anybody of any race can play anything, but I think we're getting more and more opportunities for that to happen. But I think it's still a struggle, especially now. You mentioned that this is a mostly white audience in Portland, and it's true. I think bringing up even the term whitewashing or cultural appropriation is a big deal for some of these audiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that it does hit the mark because it's coming from you.
I've had some interesting reactions, let's say, to the show throughout the years that I've been doing it. I will just say that someone today after the show, he told me that he did not like the term white people, and he asked if I could do something about it. And he felt that maybe I would have some ability to change it. I mean, it was interesting. I
that makes me sad.
I mean, I don't think I have that much power to get rid of that term, but it was very interesting that he had that reaction to the show. He felt marginalized by the term white people.
Which explains where we're at right now. I'm sorry. In this country. Wow. Okay. I'm kind of blown away by that comment because I expected a little bit better from theater people, frankly.
I want to do shows for people that, you know, I can do shows for people that agree with me, you know, so, but I don't think I should, you know, I think I should be able to do a show for somebody like that who also, I think sometimes we are also interacting with people that just aren't as well versed in. I come from a world that is very, everybody is very proficient with the right things to say about diversity and identity, right? But we also do want to do plays for people that just aren't as, it's not part of their daily vernacular. And I actually don't want to drive those people away just because they're like not caught up on the right way to say certain things. I mean, I also am just like, sometimes just stunned. So sometimes I just like listen and just go like, okay, yeah, great. I'll take that into account and we'll see if I can. I guess I'll call up like the CEO of white people and try to get that term erased.
I think you can put that in your show, yeah. You know, because your show, I'm sure, changes all the time.
I have put things like that in the show and it's not impossible that I will. I don't know if I'll have to like mull it over to see how it fits. Yeah.
You have to try it out for sure. You know, you started this show at Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is an amazing experience. And I'm sure it's changed so much. What was the reaction when you did it in Edinburgh?
Edinburgh is it was great. Edinburgh, they are very used to comedies and they have a much broader sense of what a stand-up show is. So my show at the Edinburgh Fringe is just considered a stand-up show. It's just a stand-up comedy show. And then here it's considered a play with, you know, a interesting / somewhat pretentious structure. But in Edinburgh, they didn't bat an eye. Like they're very good audiences in Edinburgh where they hone in on what they're supposed to laugh at really quickly. A really interesting challenge about Portland is finding ways to let people know that they can laugh at the show. Today's audience was great. Maybe one of the best we've had, but it's interesting in Portland. I think sometimes people have so much empathy with me that they actually don't laugh when I'm being a little satirical about myself, which as a comedian, I'm very used to like being self-deprecating and like making fun of myself. And I think sometimes actually in Portland, it's almost too warm. They're almost too compassionate when I'm poking fun at myself to be like, don't say that about yourself. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, you could laugh at it. It's a comedy.
Oh, I could see that. It's like, oh, that's so sad about him. You know, yeah. Oh, we're here for you, Chris. We're here for you. You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, you do have those different reactions, but you did put in a lot of Portland stuff. So you must do that at every time you do that to it in a different venue or a different location.
Yeah, it's customized for each venue, which I, at one point early on the run, I thought, oh, I should make audio announcements and write some material that's generic that I could just tour with. And then whatever reason, I didn't make that decision. And now every time I do the show, I have like a lot of work to do. But I think it really pays off. I think people feel it's mostly just to make you feel like the show is in the present moment for you that day. And I think it's achieved that.
Well, I also think that it makes it more homey, you know, like you're respectful of the place that you're in.
I think one of the things that I play with is there's parts of the show that are very casual, that are very, it's just me walking around telling you about stuff. And then I have other parts of the show that I want to have artifice in them, to be theatrical, to have theatrical structures in them that are a little more elevated. So I like playing between the two tones. So there are moments when somebody's speaking in the show that is very arch. And then I want other moments that just feel like, here's just a riff about Portland that I just made up, and it's just me up here talking. And the swinging between those two tones is very interesting to me.
Well, since you have adapted some local references, I have to ask, since next stop will be the Kennedy Center, and of course there's so much controversy about that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about what you're going to add there to make it more local there?
I have not. I think I will probably saying something about the entire situation, which is I'm surprised that I'm being allowed to perform at the Kennedy Center. Given the material, I would almost say that if I perform at the Kennedy Center, it's because the head honchos at the Kennedy Center have not quite examined what the show is, which is why I really want to do it, because I think it's really interesting to do the show at the Kennedy Center in this time. The people that have worked there from the theater department at the Kennedy Center are great, and they're the same people that were there a year ago, 2 years ago, and they're super supportive. So I also want to honor them because they booked me for that gig 18 months ago before any of this stuff happened, right? So I want to do the best job for them. And I mean, to put it mildly, a lot of people in the arts right now are in really awkward positions where they have to, you know, they're creating art, trying to make a salary, and they have very hostile or bizarre bosses to work for. And so we've probably all had bosses that were hard to work for, but this might be like one, you know, this is up there with some of the worst in terms of somebody that's like hostile to the values that you have about the arts. You know, it's really, it is an unfortunate situation, but I'm also very fascinated to see with how the show goes over there, because I'm not even sure what the audience is going to be, because a lot of my friends in Washington that are subscribers to the Kennedy Center obviously are not people that support the current regime, and a lot of them have canceled their tickets. I'm not totally sure who's going to sit down in front of that show that night.
I think it's awfully brave that you're doing that. But I'm also wondering if maybe just the name Scarlett Johansson is sort of covering some of this up so that, you know, they think it's a different kind of show maybe.
I mean, I think you can also see the show just as like a silly comedy. So like maybe just they just think it's that. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of comedy in it. And that is the focus. And I also think that you get in the points very subtly, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you say it out loud, mm-hmm. but it's still kind of subtle because then you make a joke, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of things to say, obviously. And what I found through the development of this show is that people will, their eyes will glaze over if you just lecture at them for an hour. So the one thing I can promise is that the show is not an hour-long lecture. And I consider that a lot of like vegetables that you have to eat. And I have to put, you know, candy in there as well. And I actually think it's a great challenge to try to create comedy that doesn't undermine the message, but gets you to keep listening, basically.
And I think you do that very well. I also want to just ask you more kind of who is Chris Grace kind of questions. You do speak about how your mom supported you mm-hmm. in there, and you adopted her name, Grace,
yeah.
in there. And I'm just wondering, what was that like growing up? You were born in Mississippi, but you grew up in Texas, yeah. and your mom was a Taiwanese immigrant. How was that like for you when you were a child?
It's growing up in Texas is really interesting. And I love Texas. Like, I still visit there, and my family's still there. And it's a very interesting place to try to be a creative person. But I was in a very active theater program in high school, and then I went to college to study it. And I think the prevailing feeling I had through all of that was that I just never actually felt like I belonged in any particular situation. And you're reminded very often that you don't belong in situations. So even like right now, above all of any other values that I have, I'm 100% an American. You know, I was born in Mississippi. I grew up in the South. There really are no values I have that are anything more than being an American. And if you're Asian in America, you're essentially like forever locked out from feeling completely American.
Perpetual foreigner.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So as an artist, that's interesting to me. You know, I am grateful that I am an artist so that I have a space to talk about this stuff. If I didn't and I was just trying to live a life without expressing that, I think that'd be a lot harder. But, you know, Texas is weird because I had a very active theater program that I would have guessed we were all very progressive people. My old theater teacher is a huge Trumper now. And it's just like, I don't know what to do with that, you know, because we were doing plays like The Crucible in high school that were talking about so many issues that are really applicable to today's government.
It's actually time for the remake of The Crucible, frankly.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to me because I just think back and I just think, well, what values were you getting from the plays you were making us do?
Did you ever have a Texas dialect, a Texan dialect?
I still think I do. I mean, I have a Texas rhythm to the cadence of the way I talk. I think it's Texan. And I just, I don't have a lot of, it doesn't take much though. Like not that I would fall into it, but like, I think that just the way that I say vowels and consonants, like if I just change them a little bit, it will sound a little more Texan. Yeah.
So your mom, she didn't get to see you do anything in theater or anything? I mean, she must have seen something.
She didn't get to see this show. Yeah. She saw other things, but there are truths in the show in terms of she was not super aware of everything. Yeah, she saw me in some stuff, but she didn't see me in tons of stuff.
I never saw Superstore?
Not that I know of. I mean, it's possible that my siblings forced her to watch some of it, but it wasn't a thing of, like, I have friends who, when they do projects, like, I have a friend who did a one-person show in Scotland, and their parents flew to Scotland for 2 weeks to see them do it, you know? And that's, like, my parents were not like that. I actually don't have any recollection of them seeing the plays that I was in high school.
First play that I was in college was The Tempest, and I had to enter from the aisle, and I invited my parents, and they were always bickering, but I came down, and I could hear them say, "That's not my daughter." And he goes, "That's your daughter." "No, that's not my daughter." It's like, as I was going down, and they were arguing. I mean, it's funny now, but it's like I think people who aren't used to what theater is, or, you know, they might know maybe TV or television more, but still, you know, they're kind of remote from what you actually do for that.
Yeah. I think for everybody, the idea of being on a TV show is such a different world than what people think it is. I mean, I still think it's surreal to like turn on a TV and see my face on it. But even beyond that, I think in the end, it is actually just a kind of workmanlike industry that has really weird highs and lows in it. But especially, I would say, in the last 10 years of television, people think you make so much more money on TV than you do. So they just think you're automatically a millionaire for having been on, you know. And sometimes, you know, I consider my run on Superstore to be great. Like, I was really happy with it, right? But it's funny because people will say, "Oh, you're working all the time." And in a good year on Superstore, if I was in 4 episodes, I would say that means I worked like 8 days in a year, in a calendar year, and got paid for 8 days of work, right? And I have to figure out how to make money and make a living the other 357 days of the year, you know? And I think it ends up being much more of a craft and a workman-like profession than people think.
Well, it's still very memorable. Yeah. And you were on kind of the duration of the seasons too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can understand. I can understand how that feels. But it was great. The will they, won't they romance between you and the character Sandra. What are your fond memories of it?
Mostly working with Calico and with Irene, who played Carol. They're two of my favorite people. And of course, their characters were sort of at odds with each other. Over me as a, you know, a trophy husband, I guess. But I was very impressed with the warmth and connection that Calico and Irene brought to the set. I mean, they're really good friends, and the connection between the cast and the crew I thought was really strong, one of the strongest I've been in on a set. And that just made it much more welcoming to be a person that's only in a small fraction of the episodes. It can be really difficult if you're not a regular and just showing up, and I think that they both made it very, very comfortable.
That's good to hear. Yeah. You know, a lot of times you hear kind of horror stories, but that seems like it was a real positive experience. We just wanted you on more, that's all. Do you have any final thoughts about your show, about where you're headed? Because you're also going to go back to Edinburgh to do like a whole new show, right? You're going to do something that I don't quite understand, that you're going to do a different thing every night at Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
Yes, I'm doing a show at Edinburgh this year that is ill-advised.
Is that the title? Ill-advised?
Actually, the name of the show is 27 Hours because there are 27 days of the festival. And I will be doing a new hour-long stand-up/comedy show every day of the month. So I actually don't know what it means right now. The only thing what it means is that it is a work in progress. So I'm warning people right at the top. You know, I think a very often stated thing these days is, you know what? You should just embrace failure. If you're willing to fail, that's how you become really good at something. And I think most versions of what people call failure in our culture are actually kind of insulated, you know, moderate successes that people call failures. And this show is almost guaranteed for me to experience genuine failure in front of paying audience members. And I do think that that is interesting.
That freaking scares me so much to even think about what that is. You have to be brave to do this.
It does scare me, but also I am very attracted to the things that scare me. So the number of people that have told me it's a bad idea just makes me want to do it more.
A lot of people have told you this. I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it's super brave.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize when you do stand-up, it really is you're doing a one-person show.
Yeah. And what I'm actually going to try to not improvise it. So I have a lot of improv background. Not to say that it would be the best show, but I could structure a show that's, hey, every day I'm going to improvise an hour of stand-up. That is feasible, that I could do a workman, tolerable, passable job doing that for a month. That is not my ambition this month, in this August. My ambition is to genuinely make an attempt to write material every day for the whole month. So we'll see. By day 11, I might be improvising them all.
Well, it kind of reminds me of sometimes November is like write a novel in a month, you know, kind of thing. So I can see that happening with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think on a larger scale, I just want to put out I want to generate a lot of material, and I want to generate material past the point. Like, I could tell you right now, there's probably like 8 topics that I could like write an hour long show, right? I don't know what the 9th, 10th, and 11th shows are. So I kind of want to see what happens when the well has run dry and I keep going. I think that's interesting. And also on a longer scale, I have this idea to take these 27 shows and boil them down to one show for next year. Like, I think that's a really interesting idea. Generate 27 hours of content and try to like take the best of it and make 1 hour out of it.
Well, I've been to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, and I have to say, they expect experimentation, and they probably respect that you're trying to do something that you've never done before. Mm-hmm. So I assume that the audiences will be friendlier.
They might. I mean, there's still going to be people that are going to say, we paid £10 for this and this is not entertaining. But you know what? That happens with many Edinburgh Fringe shows, not just experimental ones. That also happens with ones that are written and rehearsed.
It's true. It's true. Well, hopefully there's a bar there too. So.
Yeah.
So do you have any final thoughts about your show or any favorite moments from it that you want to share?
No, I still love doing this show. I still feel present with the audience every time I do it. It's been really interesting to develop it over the life of the show, where it's in front of all these different audiences. It's here in Portland, where there's definitely a different special vibe here. And it's going to morph even in the next weeks as I finish this run. And that part is fascinating to me. So I still am not tired of doing the show. I still love doing it. And so I hope people come and find the same excitement that I do.
I would love if somehow Scarlett Johansson showed up in your audience at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah, I would love that too. I'll hold a seat every day in the front row.
That would be a thing.
Yeah.
That would be a thing that you could do. That's awesome. Well, thank you. It's been so wonderful to meet you, Chris Grace. Portland Center Stage and Boom Arts presents Chris Grace as Scarlett Johansson. The show runs through June 22nd at the Portland Center Stage's Ellen By Theater, and that plays a prominent role in Chris Grace's Scarlett Johansson. I have that link and this interview at stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. And for those outside of Portland, you can actually see a stream of your show, Chris Grace and Scarlett Johansson, on the streaming service Dropout. Chris Grace, it really is wonderful to meet you and to have this chance. I feel very honored to be able to talk with you. Congratulations on your show.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the interview.
That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. Till the next conversation, I'm Dee Maylo Roberts.